I escorted Thanos back from the temple to his own sparsely furnished quarters, close to the dock at which his squadron was moored. Although I walked beside him with my hand on the hilt of my dagger, prepared for the consequences of his foolhardy honesty to be visited on us immediately, Thanos was quite unrepentant. Indeed, he seemed oblivious to the depths of his folly, and inordinately pleased with himself. I have often remarked how a man, freshly released from terrible strain and mortal danger, becomes garrulous and elated. Even Thanos, the hardened warrior, was no exception. It was time somebody stood up and said what needed to be said. Don't you agree, old friend? His voice rang clear and loud down the darkened alley, as though he were determined to summon any awaiting assassin to us. I kept my agreement muted. You did not expect it of me, did you? Be honest with me, Taita. It took you quite by surprise, did it not? It surprised us all. This time I could agree with a little more enthusiasm. Even Pharaoh was taken aback, as well he might be. He listened, Taita. He took it all in, I could tell. I did good work this evening, don't you think so? When I attempted to raise the subject of Rasva's treacherous attack upon him, and broached the possibility that it might have been inspired by my lord Intef, Thanos would have none of it. That's impossible, Taita. You dreamed it. Lord Intef was my father's dearest friend. How could he wish me ill? Besides, I am to be his son-in-law, am I not? And despite his injuries, he let out such a happy shout of laughter that it roused the sleepers in the darkened huts that we were passing, and they shouted grumpily back to us to be quiet. Thanos ignored their protests. No, 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 I'm sure that you are wrong, he cried. It was simply Rasva working out his spite in his own charming way. Well, he'll know better next time. He threw his arm around my shoulders and hugged me so hard that it hurt. You saved me twice tonight. Without your warnings, Rasva would have had me both times. How do you do these things, Taita? I swear you're a secret warlock, and have the gift of the inner eye. He laughed again. How could I stifle his joy? He was like a boy, a big, rambustious boy. I could not help but love him all the more. This was not the time to point out the danger in which he had placed himself and all of us who were his friends. Let him have his hour, and tomorrow I would sound the voice of reason and of caution. So I took him home and stitched the gash in his forehead and washed his other wounds and anointed them with my special mixture of honey and herbs to prevent mortification. Then I gave him a stiff draught of the red chopin and left the good Kratos to guard his slumbers. When I reached my own quarters, well after midnight, there were two summonses awaiting me, one from my lady Lostris and the other from the vanquished Rasva. There was no doubt as to which of them I would have responded to if I had been given the choice, but I was not. Rasva's two thugs almost dragged me away to where he lay on a sweat-soaked mattress, cursing and moaning by turns, and calling on Seth and all the gods to witness his pain and his fortitude. "Good Taita," he greeted me, raising himself painfully on one elbow. "You will not believe the pain. My chest is afire. I swear every bone in it is crushed, and my head aches as though it is bound by thongs of rawhide." With very little effort, I was able to force back my tears of pity. But it is a strange thing about those of us who are doctors and healers, that we cannot find it in our hearts to deny our skills to even the most abominable creatures that require them. I sighed with resignation, unpacked the leather bag that contained my medical equipment, and set out my instruments and unguents. I was delighted to find that Rasva's self-diagnosis was perfectly valid, and that apart from numerous contusions and shallow wounds, at least three of his ribs were broken, and there was a lump on the back of his head almost the size of my fist. I had, therefore, a perfectly legitimate reason for adding considerably to his discomfort. One of the broken ribs was seriously out of alignment, and there was genuine danger that it might pierce the lung. While his two thugs held him down, and Rasva squealed and howled most gratifyingly, I manipulated the rib back into place and strapped up his chest with linen bandages, well soaked in vinegar, to shrink as they dried. Then I addressed myself to the lump at the back of his skull, where it had struck the stone paving. The gods are often generous. When I held a lamp to Rasva's eyes, the pupils did not dilate. There was not the least doubt in my mind as to what treatment was required. Bloody fluid was gathering inside that unlovely skull. Without my help, Rasva would be dead by the following sunset. I thrust aside the obvious temptation and reminded myself of the surgeon's duty to his patient. There are probably only three surgeons in all of Egypt who are capable of trepanning a skull with a good chance of success, and personally I would not put much faith in the other two. Once again I ordered Rasva's two oafs to take hold of him, to control his struggles and to hold him face down on his mattress. By the roughness of their handling and their obvious disregard for their master's injured ribs, I surmised that they were not exactly overflowing with loving feeling towards their master. Once again a chorus of howls and squeals turned the night hideous and gladdened my labours, as I made a semicircular incision around the lump on his scalp, and then peeled a large flap of skin away from the bone. Now not even those two strapping ruffians could hold him down. His struggles were splashing blood as high as the ceiling of the room, and sprinkling us all so that we seemed to be inflicted with a red pox. At last, in exasperation, I ordered them to bind his ankles and wrists to the bedposts with leather straps.
"Oh, gentle and sweet Taita, the pain is beyond belief. Give me but a drop of that flower juice, I beg you, dear friend," he blubbered.
Now that he was safely bound to the bed, I could afford to be frank with him. "I understand, my good Rasva, just how you feel. I also would have been grateful for a little of the flower when last you took the knife to me. Alas, old comrade, my store of the drug is finished, and there will not be another eastern caravan for at least a month," I lied cheerfully, for very few knew that I cultivated the red chopin myself, knowing that the best was yet to come. I reached for my bone drill. The human head is the only part of the body that puzzles me as a doctor. At the orders of my Lord Intef, the corpses of all executed criminals are handed over to me. In addition, Tanos has been able to bring me many fine specimens from the battlefield, suitably pickled in vats of brine. All these I have dissected and studied, so that I know every bone and how it fits into its exact place in the skeleton. I have traced the route by which food enters the mouth and passes through the body. I have found that great and wondrous organ, the heart, nestling between the pale air bladders of the lungs. I have studied the rivers of the body through which the blood flows, and I have observed the two types of blood which determine the moods and emotions of man. There is, of course, that bright, joyous blood that, when released by the cut of the scalpel or the headsman's axe, spurts out in regular impulses. This is the blood of happy thoughts and fine emotions. It is the blood of love and kindness. Then there is that darker, sullen blood that flows without the vigour and the bounding joy of the other. This is the blood of anger and of sorrow, of melancholic thoughts and evil deeds. All these matters I have studied, and have filled 100 papyrus rolls with my observations. There is no man in the world that I know of who has gone to such lengths, certainly none of those quacks in the temple with their amulets and their incantations have done so. I doubt any of them could tell the liver from the sphincter of the anus without an invocation from Osiris, a casting of the divine dice and a fat fee paid in advance. In all modesty, I can say that I have never met a man who understands the human body better than I, and yet the head is still a puzzle to me. Naturally, I understand that the eyes see, the nose smells, the mouth tastes, and the ears hear, but what is the purpose of that pale porridge that fills the gourd of the skull? I have never been able to fathom it myself, and no man has ever been able to offer me a satisfactory explanation, except that Tanis came closest to it. After he and I had spent an evening together sampling the latest vintage of red wine, he had woken in the dawn and suggested with a groan, "Seth has placed this thing in our heads as his revenge on mankind." I once met a man who was travelling with a caravan from beyond those legendary twin rivers, the Tigris and the Euphrates, who professed to have studied the same problem. He was a wise man, and together we debated many mysteries over the course of half a year. At one point he suggested that all human emotion and thought sprang not from the heart, but from those soft amorphous curds that make up the brain. I mention this naive assertion only to demonstrate how gravely even an intelligent and learned man can err. Nobody who has ever considered that mighty organ, the heart, leaping with its own life in the centre of our body, fed by great rivers of blood, protected by the palisades of bone, can doubt that this is the fountain from which all thought and emotion springs. The heart uses the blood to disseminate these emotions throughout the body. Have you ever felt your heart stir within you and quicken to beautiful music, or a lovely face, or the fine words of a moving speech? Have you ever felt anything leaping around inside your head? Even the wise man from the East had to capitulate before my ruthless logic. No rational man can believe that a bloodless puddle of curdled milk lying inert in its bony jar could conjure up the lines of a poem or the design of a pyramid, could cause a man to love or to wage war. Even the embalmers scoop it out and discard it when they prepare a corpse for the long journey. There is, however, a paradox here, in that if this glutinous mass is interfered with, even by the pressure of trapped fluid upon it, the patient is certainly doomed. It requires an intimate knowledge of the structure of the head and a quite marvellous dexterity to be able to drill through the skull without disturbing the sac that contains this porridge. I have both these attributes. As I ground down slowly through the bone, encouraged by Rasfer's bellows, I paused regularly to wash away the bone chips and filings by splashing vinegar into the wound. The sting of the liquid added little to the patient's well-being, but revived the flagging volume of his voice. Suddenly, the sharp bronze drill bit cleanly through the skull, and a tiny but perfect circle of bone was blown out of the wound by the pressure within. It was followed immediately by a spurt of dark clotted blood that hit me in the face. Immediately, Rasfer relaxed under me. I knew, not without a sneaking pang of regret, that he would survive. As I stitched the flap of scalp back into place, covering the aperture in the depths of which the dura mater pulsed ominously, I wondered if I had truly done mankind a great service by preserving the specimen of it. When I left Rasfer with his head swathed in bandages, snoring and whimpering in porcine self-pity, I found that I was completely exhausted. The excitements and alarms of the day had expended even my vast store of energy. However, there was to be no rest for me yet, for my Lady Lostrey's messenger still hovered on the terrace of my quarters and pounced on me as I set foot on the first step. I was allowed only sufficient grace to wash away Rasfer's blood and change my soiled raiment. As I tottered into her chamber, barely able to place one foot before the other, my Lady Lostrey's met me with blazing eyes and ominously tapping foot. "Just where do you think you've been hiding yourself, Master Taita?" she lashed out at me immediately. "I sent for you before the second watch, and it's now not much short of dawn. How dare you keep me waiting so? Sometimes you forget your station. You know full well the punishment for impertinent slaves." She was in full flight, having let her impatience brew for all these hours. In anger, her beauty is stunning, and when she stamped her foot in that adorable gesture that was so typically her own, I thought that my heart must burst with my love for her. "Don't you stand there grinning at me," she flared at me. "I am so truly angry that I could order you flogged." She stamped her foot again, and I felt the tiredness fall from my shoulders like a heavy load. Her mere presence had the power to revitalize me. "My lady, what a wondrous role you played this night. It seemed to me and all who watched you that it was indeed the divine goddess that walked amongst us." "Don't you dare try your tricks with me," she stamped for the third time, but without conviction. "You will not wriggle out of this so easily. Truly, my lady, as I walked back from the temple through the crowded streets, your name was on every tongue. They said your singing was the finest they had ever heard, and had quite stolen every heart." "I believe not a word," she declared, but she was clearly having difficulty sustaining her fury. "In fact, I thought my voice was awful this evening. I was flat at least once, and off-key on numerous—" "I must contradict you, mistress. You were never better. And what beauty! It lit the whole temple." "She is not truly vain, my Lady Lostrey's, but she is a woman." "You awful man," she cried in exasperation. "I was ready to have you flogged this time, I truly was. But come and sit beside me on the bed and tell me all about it. I am still so excited that I am sure I will not sleep for a week." She took my hand and led me to the bed, babbling on happily about Thanos, and how he must have won every heart as well as Pharaoh's with his wonderful performance and fearless speech, and how the infant Horus had beshat her dress. And did I truly think that she had sung even passing well, and wasn't I just saying so? At last I had to stop her. "My lady, it is almost dawn, and we must be ready to leave with all the court to accompany the king when he crosses the river to inspect his funerary temple and his tomb. You must get some sleep if you are to look your best on such an important state occasion." "I'm not sleepy, Taita," she protested, and went chattering on, only to slump against my shoulder a few minutes later, fallen asleep in mid-sentence. Gently I slipped her head down onto the carved wooden headrest and covered her with a rug of colobus monkey furs. I could not bring myself to leave immediately, but hovered beside her bed. At last I placed a gentle kiss upon her cheek. She did not open her eyes, but whispered sleepily, "Do you think there will be an opportunity for me to speak to the king tomorrow? Only he will be able to prevent my father sending Thanos away." I could think of no ready answer for her, and while I still dithered, she fell fully asleep.